Thank you very much. Marshall, if you can call the court to order.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Flory, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes, Jr. presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, December 15th, 2021. We are holding this via zoom.gov. Our apologies for the delay in the hearing. I know this is originally scheduled for 10:50 and it's now approximately 11:25. We were having some technical difficulties. As wonderful as technology is, there can be challenges as well. So we appreciate your patience and we appreciate you joining us via Zoom. If we do run into any technical issues while we are going through our proceedings, we'll make sure to make the appropriate accommodations. Certainly feel free to either raise your hand with that symbol or to let us know if there are some issues for some reason. However, while the opposing counsel is talking, we would ask that you mute yourself so we cannot hear you. This hearing will be recorded. No other recordings are permitted. This is the third case that we have on our oral calendar today out of the four cases. And this case is A21-0343, Kelly Susan Lapata versus Timothy Michael Lapata. My apologies if I mispronounced the last name. I tend to go with the Spanish pronunciation. We would ask also that when you start, make sure you state your name for the record and the party you're representing. If you will look on the screen, you should see a clock that will have your time, 15 minutes for appellant, initial arguments, and then 15 minutes for respondent, and then 5 minutes for appellant for rebuttal if you so choose. With that, we are ready to proceed. Counsel for appellant, please begin.
Good morning, Your Honors and counsel. My name is Shannon Ort, and I am with the law firm of Terzich and Ort. I represent the appellant, Professor Tim Lapara, in this appeal before Your Honors today. The Laparas appeared before the trial court over disputes regarding spousal maintenance, child support, and attorney fees. We are here today seeking review of the trial court's order granting to respondent Ms. Lapara an award of spousal maintenance. We are asking for a review of the court's calculation of the spousal maintenance and the court's corresponding calculation of child support. The district court's determination that respondent Ms. Lapara was entitled to spousal maintenance is reviewed by this court under an abuse of discretion standard. Case law has further guided this court regarding review. The Clark case in particular has held that misapplication of the law constitutes an abuse of discretion. And the Gessner court has held that spousal maintenance awards should be overturned if it is against logic and the facts on the record. Here, the Lapara case, we believe there has been abuse of discretion with regard to the award of spousal maintenance. The award cannot be sustained or upheld as we believe that there has been a misapplication of the law. The Minnesota Supreme Court has determined that the threshold for an award of spousal maintenance is need. The burden to demonstrate need for an award of spousal maintenance falls on Ms. Lapara as the requesting party. This threshold of need is contained in Minnesota Statute 518-552. As the court thinks about the concept of need, the analysis requires the court to look at the income earned by the requesting party and compare that with a reasonable monthly budget consistent with the marital standard of living. Here, the trial court abused its discretion by awarding any spousal maintenance to Ms. Lapara when she failed to demonstrate any need.
I'm sorry, Ms. Ort, but aren't you ignoring subdivision 2 of that statute?
So with regard to the statutory factors, 518-552 subdivision 1 establishes the threshold, and the person requesting spousal maintenance must first establish need.
Exactly. I'm sorry. Oh, I was talking about, in subdivision 1, it talks about the standards of living during the marriage. So, and that's, and the judge discussed that in its order. So why doesn't that satisfy subdivision one is maybe what I should have asked.
Yes, because the court properly started its analysis with a review of Respondent Lapara's budget. Ms. Lapara submitted a budget of approximately $7,800. The district court...
That doesn't get to standard of living during the marriage, though, right?
The budget is the standard of living. It is the reasonable monthly budget in consideration of the standard.
Considering the standard of living established during the marriage, correct?
Correct.
And so the standard of living, the court found, was an upper middle class standard of living.
Correct.
And so the judge made a decision that based on wife's lower level of earnings, among other things, and it even attributed additional income, saying the 30 hours a week doesn't cut it, and then said, but husband's earning a heck of a lot more, and they're used to living in that standard. That was the standard of living during the marriage. So why was the judge wrong?
So I think the answer is twofold. First, I would submit that the court's analysis of Ms. Lapara's budget, when they did that analysis, they did so through the guise of the marital standard of living. The court reduced Ms. Lapara's proposed budget and identified a reasonable monthly budget at $5,635. That is the ceiling. That is her need and her income plus the child support without imputation of income to her meets that budget. The court then moves on to this analysis.
Didn't the court deduct out child support expenses from her budget and did not consider after tax, though? I mean, there is a real deficit, yes?
Absolutely, there's not a deficit. Exhibit 1.
Why is there not a deficit? So explain that to me.
Yes. Exhibit 114 was submitted to the trial court. It is an expert cash flow analysis created by CPA Dax Stoner. The analysis in Exhibit 114 clearly shows that using Mr. Lapara's guaranteed income as a professor and the income attributed by the district court for Ms. Lapara, $5,733, it identifies both the after-tax cash flow. And what this exhibit shows is Ms. Lapara has $6,290 after-tax cash flow to meet a budget determined by the court to
$5,000. And that still does not answer the question of the standard of living during the marriage based on their combined incomes. Right? I mean, she still is not close to their combined incomes during the year divided by half, correct?
I disagree with the court. And the reason I disagree was because of Exhibit 114. Review of that document shows Ms. Lapara has after-tax cash flow of $6,290 and Mr. Lapara has after-tax cash flow of $4,878. There's a discrepancy, a disparity in the earnings in Ms. Lapara's favor.
Ms. Orr, I just want to make sure I'm clearly understand what you're saying. Are you referring to Mr. Lapara's testimony and documentation?
I'm referring to Exhibit 114 in the court. It was an expert exhibit provided by and created by the only CPA that testified in the trial. Mr. Stoner testified regarding the pre-tax and post-tax consequences.
Right, but whose expert was this?
Oh, excuse me. It was Mr. Lapara's expert.
Right. And so you when you went through the standard of review, one thing that I think is missing is that there's no motion for a new trial that was made. So our review is very limited in this instance. We are only looking at issues as to whether or not the evidence sustains the district court's findings and whether those findings support the district court's conclusions of law and judgment. So we're not at the stage, and even then as an appellate court, we're not at the stage of weighing the evidence and looking through the record. All we're looking at is the district court's findings, and the district court made specific findings in terms of what her monthly expenses were and what her income was, noted a disparity, and said, because of that, I'm going to be granting spousal maintenance of approximately $1,400. So why is that finding by the district court, that specific finding by the district court based on her monthly expenses that he found, reasonable monthly expenses, and her current gross monthly income? Why is that erroneous?
Well, again, because it doesn't satisfy, again, if the court determines a reasonable monthly budget consistent with the marital standard of living is $5,635, and Ms. LaPara's income exceeds that amount with the exchange of child support, they cannot satisfy the need threshold. Then the court, because the court should have stopped its analysis at that point, it didn't, right? It went on to address in kind of summary fashion the factors in 518-552 subdivision 2, which are the 8 factors that would guide the court's analysis.
But let me stop you there. I'm and maybe I'm seeing this too simply, but her monthly expenses were about $5,600. Her monthly gross income was about $4,300, right?
The court determined her gross income was $5,733.
That's gross income, though.
Correct.
And that's different than net. The net income is going to be less than that.
Correct. And that's where the cash, the only information that was provided to the court regarding net income and cash flow is the exhibit provided by Mr. Stoner. There was no objection. There was no contest regarding the accuracy of those cash flow numbers. But that those net numbers, again, document that she has excess income after the exchange of child support.
But wasn't the court free to reject the testimony of Mr. Stoner and make its own calculations based on the evidence before it?
I agree with Your Honor that the court had the opportunity to do that, but it didn't. It accepted Mr. Stoner's calculations. It actually did no analysis in the entire order of the after-tax net cash flow issues.
Except that those calculations, I mean, child support is for the children, correct?
Yes.
And you have to compare apples to apples. So in your Exhibit 114, it adds child support to wife's gross income or income, and it deducts it from husband's, correct?
Correct.
But that's not what she gets to spend on herself. The court, in calculating her budget, figured out her expenses for herself, taking out childcare expenses. So what you're asking us to do is to say that we're going to add in childcare support without adding in the childcare expenses. I mean, that's money to go to the kids. It's not money to go to the wife, I guess is all I'm trying to say. And the cash flow analysis is based on, here, we're giving you, wife, the money you're going to get for the kids, and we're going to add that into your income, and now can you afford everything? But that's not how it works, I don't think. Or am I wrong? And then explain to me why I'm wrong. Because in calculating gross income, for example, the statute specifically says you don't calculate in amounts received for child care support.
An award of spousal maintenance would include the total income available to Ms. LaPara to meet her reasonable monthly expenses consistent with the standard of living. So it is the total cash flow brought into her house, which is her income plus the child support paid. And then we look to see if there's a shortfall. Did that answer your question, Your Honor? I see my time is running short. I'd like to address the court's the inclusion. There is, in 518-552, we are required to look at the 8 factors to determine the appropriate amount and duration of spousal maintenance. Here, the court made no analysis other than some conclusory statements about the parties lived in upper middle class standard of living. None of that is disputed. Where the court erred is its conclusion that considering the party's income and expenses, Ms. LaPara is left with relatively, quote, less financial cushion than Mr. LaPara. There exists no basis in the law to award spousal maintenance to create a cushion. We look at a budget, what the budgetary shortfall is, and that's how we determine the amount of spousal maintenance. The court has addressed this issue directly in the Schneider case. The Schneider case indicates that the purpose of spousal maintenance is to provide the party's need, and it is not a profit-sharing plan. This district court exactly ruled by awarding spousal maintenance that they were going to engage in a profit-sharing plan, sharing in the income earned by Mr. LaPara's second job, grant writing, and there was no correlation between the amount of spousal maintenance awarded and Ms. LaPara's budget need, nor was there any correlation between the duration. For example, normally we would see someone needs a rehabilitative period. It's going to take X number of years. Here, the duration was simply a request by Ms. LaPara for 7 years of spousal maintenance, and there is no evidence in the record as to how that duration was identified, nor was it a correlation to the monthly budget. There was a nonsensical way of calculating the spousal maintenance award, which was averaging earnings from a second job.
Is there any case law to support your position that it was an abuse of discretion for the judge to try to figure out how long to allow? I mean, isn't there broad discretion? And do you have any case law that supports your position that we should be scrutinizing that decision more closely?
With the duration issue, I, off the top of my head, I'm not aware of case law that supports that. The point is the duration typically under the statute 518-552 has some correlation to what is the rehabilitative period. Here, there's nothing in the record regarding why that duration would be appropriate.
Thank you, Ms. Orton. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel, for respondent, you'll have 15 minutes. The clock has been reset for you, so you may proceed.
Morning. May it please the court and opposing counsel. I am attorney Lindsay Fishbach of Barnaguzzi and Steffen, and together with attorney Beverly Dodge of Barnaguzzi and Steffen, we represent the respondent, Ms. Kelly LaPara. Let me begin with one agreement the parties and counsel appear to have. As discussed in respondent's brief, we agree that the district court should have included the amount of monthly spousal maintenance it ordered appellant to pay to respondent within its guideline child support calculations. We further agree that if that is done, appellant's guideline child support obligations to respondent modify to $1,898 per month in basic support, and the party's PICS, parental income for determining child support, modify to 67% appellant and 33% respondent. I'll now turn to the disputed issues in this appeal. Appellant is challenging the district court's award of temporary spousal maintenance to respondent, as well as the district court's determination of guideline child support to respondent for the party's minor children. I will begin by discussing the issue of spousal maintenance. It was well within the district court's discretion to conclude that respondent is entitled to temporary spousal maintenance from appellant in the amount and the duration that it awarded to her. The district court applied the appropriate law to the case, and the evidence presented to the district court sustains the findings of fact made related to spousal maintenance in its judgment and decree.
Ms. Fishbach, you reference you make the argument that case law supports that decision, but wouldn't you agree that the district court undertook a rather unusual method to calculate that amount?
And I would agree with you on that. Yes, I would agree it was an unusual way to get there. I think, though, looking at all things considered, it makes sense, particularly if we get into specifics of numbers. which you've already discussed the appropriate standard of review, and I don't think we're here to second guess necessarily what was done, but Ms. Ort did reference Trial Exhibit 114, which is cash flow proposed by their expert. And I think if we look at Exhibit 114 and get very specific about the party's specific after-tax cash flow for purposes of spousal maintenance, the evidence sustains that it's appropriate for the court to order temporary spousal maintenance of the amount that it did to the respondent in this case. I can go more specifics into specific details as to how we get there, if that would be helpful. All right. Just to give you an idea. So there's Trial Exhibit 114, and Alternative B is what the appellant has focused on, which Judge Siegel noted is based upon respondent having income from full-time employment, which she does not currently have, and from receiving child support of $1,711 per month from appellant, which should not be considered in determining spousal maintenance. If we turn to the statute, Minnesota Statute 518.552, Subdivision 1, Subdivision 1, Section B, the court specifically found that the respondent is in need of spousal maintenance because she is unable to provide appropriate self-support through appropriate employment. There's nothing within that subsection of the statute indicating child support should be considered in determining a party's need for spousal maintenance. Now, turning back to this Exhibit 114, Alternative B is what the appellant likes to focus on, like I said. But I think if we work off of that, we really need to pull out the child support amount that is being paid to the respondent in order to determine what Ms. LaPera's monthly need is to meet her own needs. As Judge Siegel noted, the district court appropriately removed minor children's expenses from both parties' budgets. And so when we focus just on Ms. LaPera's income, whether it's at her current 0.75 position or at her full-time future position in her current role, running the numbers, pulling out the child support, applying the appropriate tax amounts, which are in that Exhibit 114, we can still see that Ms. LaPera has a shortfall every month and that the number the district court determined was appropriate is within the range of reasonable outcomes given those calculations. So then turning back to analysis of spousal maintenance here, it is correct that the threshold is to meet Subdivision 1 of Minnesota Statute 518.552, which the district court appropriately determined was met. And then the district court was to move forward to Subdivision 2 of Minnesota Statute 518.552 to review statutory factors related to amount and duration of temporary spousal maintenance. As detailed on pages 4 and 5 of respondents' brief, the district court included many specific reasons related to those statutory factors to support its award of temporary spousal maintenance to respondent. As everybody knows, the necessity of spousal maintenance requires the court to balance a party's need for spousal maintenance against the other party's ability to pay spousal maintenance. Here, the district court found that the appellant has the ability to pay the respondent the $424.88 temporary spousal maintenance, and it specifically found that his argument that he could not do so unpersuasive, as he had previously paid temporary family support of $3,250 to the respondent from June of 2019 through trial in September and October of 2020. Again, we can look specifically at the calculations within that Exhibit 114 and extrapolate numbers to see that even with the payment of child support to Ms. LaPera, plus the spousal maintenance the court has ordered, Mr. LaPera has the ability to do so. He can meet his own monthly budget determined by the court, plus make all those other payments and have additional funds left over at the end. I think the court's analysis in taking what Mr. LaPera earns over the course of one summer and dividing it over the course of 7 years, the time period requested for spousal maintenance, is a bit unusual, but really it's awarding Ms. LaPera about 3.5% of his total income over the course of 7 years. And so I don't think that's anything outside of the court's discretion to do, considering especially the marital standard of living, which is discussed a lot by the district court, and which forms the basis of the court's decision for enabling Ms. LaPara to have some time to become self-supporting, which is ultimately the purpose of the spousal maintenance statute. Now, turning to the issue of child support, appellant has three primary arguments as to why he believes the district court's child support determination for the party's minor children was an abuse of discretion. As discussed in respondents' briefs, appellant's arguments failed to address the fact that the appellant's University of Minnesota professorship employment contract is for 9 months of the year. And he actually works for the University of Minnesota just 9 months out of the year. Whereas Minnesota law presumes a parent can be employed full-time over the course of a year. Appellant specifically argues the district court should have excluded his income from his summer grant research work because of Minnesota statute section 518A.29B, which provides statutory requirements for excluding income earned by a party for employment in excess of a 40-hour work week for child support purposes. That section of the statute does not apply here because appellant is not working 40-hour work weeks year-round in his University of Minnesota employment. Further, that section of the statute specifically requires that the party's excess employment began after the filing of the petition for dissolution, which is not the case here, as appellant engaged in summer grant research work consistently throughout the party's marriage and in the 4 years leading up to trial in this matter. Appellant also—
Ms. Fishbach, and you might be getting to this already, so my apologies for interrupting, but it is, why should the district court have included that as periodic income, because there's no guarantee that that income will occur in the future. I mean, just because he's received it in the past, it's a grant, and grants can come and go. And it's very possible that that grant either won't be available or he won't qualify for it going forward. So isn't it really speculative by including, assuming that he's going to continue to get that?
I don't think so, given the facts in this case. I think that the court indicated that he has done this summer grant research work throughout the course of the party's marriage, 14 years without issue. He's done it the last 4 summers leading up to trial in this matter, and it's been regular and consistent. The same argument is often made regarding parties' bonuses, and that they, you know, we don't, can't count on that, and it shouldn't be included in future child support obligations. But again, we look to history, and if it's been consistently earned, I think it is reasonable for the court to conclude that it is indeed periodic income that should be included for child support purposes. Obviously, if things change significantly in the future, child support is always modifiable. And so that could be brought forward to the court to make child support more equitable if there was a serious change in circumstances. The other argument that's advanced as to why Mr. LaPara's summer grant research income should not be included for child support purposes is Minnesota statute section 518A.32, which imputes income to parties. And that statute again is presumed upon a presumption a parent can be employed full-time over the course of the year. As I noted, it's undisputed he is not employed full-time by the University of Minnesota over the course of the year. It's further undisputed he has consistently engaged in the summer grant research work throughout the party's marriage and in the last 4 years leading up to trial in this matter. Therefore, it was well within the district court's discretion to impute the summer grant research work income received by respondent to him for child support purposes. It should be noted that this is essentially equivalent to what the district court did for respondent's income for child support purposes, and that she has worked in a 0.75 position since the birth of the party's second child. But the district court applied Minnesota statute 518A.32 and appropriately imputed income to her for child support purposes based upon if she were employed in her current employment full time. In other words, to exclude appellant's summer grant research work income would be essentially permitting him to work a 0.75 position over the course of the year, which the district court did not conclude was appropriate for respondent for child support purposes. Unless you have any further questions for me, that concludes my argument.
Any questions from the other panel members at all? Looks like we do not have any more questions. Thank you very much, Ms. Fishbach. Ms. Ort, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. The clock is set and you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to address just a little bit further the calculation of the spousal maintenance. As I indicated, there was no correlation between Ms. LaPara's budgetary shortfall or need in the calculation of maintenance. In fact, the calculation, as we've discussed, is very, very unusual. And again, there's no basis for that calculation. The nonsensical calculation takes the last 4 years of Mr. LaPara's earnings from his second job and then divided it over 7 years, the duration requested by Ms. LaPara, again, with no correlation between her budgetary needs. The court in Chamberlain stated that the marital standard of living, which is identified by the budget, the $5,635, creates the ceiling. Once the ceiling is met, an award of spousal maintenance is not justified. So when we look at the income available, Ms. LaPara is above that ceiling. I'd now like to talk a little bit regarding the child support calculation. The council made a statement that it was undisputed that Professor LaPara was employed on a less than full-time basis, and that is inconsistent with the facts in the record. Professor LaPara is employed full-time. He's employed by the University of Minnesota. He's a tenured professor, and he teaches 9 months out of the year, but he's compensated by a salary paid over 12 months. Never have I seen the court impute
Wait. Isn't the evidence pretty uncontroverted that he could have chosen to get it over 9 months or 12 months and that his obligations to the university are only for 9 months? I mean, I just don't get that argument.
Well,
and then how do you respond to Ms. Fishbach's argument? Well, 0.25 was attributed to, income of added into the gross income of a wife. So why shouldn't what's fair for the wife be fair for the husband?
We would be going down a very slippery slope if we set a precedent that teachers are not full-time employees. The statute 518A29 subdivision B talks directly about industries in which a 40-hour work week is not the industry standard. Teachers and professors are employed full-time. For example, they're not eligible in the summer to ask for unemployment benefits while their contract is requiring them to work, have office hours, teach a class during the 9 months. They are not unemployed during the summer. Their contract is an annual contract. So suggesting that teachers or professors are less than a 40-hour full-time employee is inconsistent with really their job. In fact, the HR director testified at trial that Mr. LaPara is in fact a full-time member, faculty member. He has no obligations outside of his 9-month teaching contract, but he is considered a full-time employee. In fact,
Ms. Ord, we're not talking here about whether or not teachers are required to work beyond the 9 months. What we're looking at are the particular facts here and whether or not he did, in fact, work beyond the 9-month full-time period and whether or not that should be included in the calculation for child support purposes. So I think those are two very different and distinct issues.
I believe that the district court erred in its presumption that it was required to impute income to Mr. LaPara because it determined that he was only working full-time over 9 months, instead of applying the exception that's identified in 518A29.
So what do we look at besides the university said, yeah, we consider him a full-time professor? What is there in the record to show that the judge made a clear error? Because that's a factual, I mean, it may be a mixed question of law and fact, but where is the abuse of discretion there? Besides, I mean, is the only evidence that the university says, yeah, we consider somebody who's teaching 9 months a year as a faculty member, et cetera, that they're full-time? I mean, the employer definition is different from the statute, right? So So what is there to say, I can't work more than I'm working now at the university, because that's really full time, and anything beyond that's a stretch. I mean, it seems like he's not only doing the summer research, but he's taken on work in addition to that, correct?
He was required to, yes, because of the financial constraints, correct.
Yeah, so back to the question, is there something in the record we should be looking at besides the university saying, yes, we define this as full-time?
Yes, at page 12 of the court's judgment decree, the court specifically found that Mr. LaPara's main employment as a professor is full-time. And he works in an industry that does not adhere to a strict 40-hour work week. So it specifically agrees that he is working full-time, yet it erred by then indicating that that full-time was only 9 months, and it felt that it then needed to impute income to him for a full-time position. So the court's findings are inconsistent with one another.
Thank you, Ms. Ort. Any other questions by the panel? Okay. Thank you both very much for your arguments and your briefing. Both were well done, and we appreciate that.